Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus. The Age of Heroes has dawned and the quest for optimal wellness continues. Tonight on The Art of Healing with Dr. Kak Young. Greetings and welcome, Kak. How are you tonight?
Thank you. I'm just great. And we have a wonderful show tonight, Hercules. My guest tonight is Scarlett Heinbuch, PhD. Now, she holds a PhD in public policy and administration from Virginia Commonwealth University, known as VCU, and she has a master's degree in public health from VCU School of Medicine. Now, I don't know what that is, so we'll ask her. Scarlett is also certified in Reiki, hypnotherapy, neurolinguistic programming, and she is the author of We Met on the Other Side. Tonight, I'd like to welcome Scarlett to The Art of Healing.
Welcome, Scarlett.
Well, thank you. Can you all hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming a little low on my end. How about with you, Kak?
Yeah, a little bit low.
Okay, can you hear me better now?
Much better.
Okay, very good. Hi.
Hi, welcome, welcome. All right, we're going to talk about your book tonight. We Met on the Other Side is the story of Scarlett's encounter with a near-death man named David. Now, we're going to talk a lot about the story tonight, but we're going to leave out the ending because we want you to go out and buy the book and find out for yourself how it all turned out. The beginning and middle are fascinating because they involve two worlds, ours and the other. I really believe that this book will change your life standing of what lies beyond. Scarlett, you had an NDE, a near-death experience, at the age of 4, and you said that a portal opened up to the other side, and you had many experiences while on the other side. Please tell us about that.
Okay. Well, you know, when I was 4, I had a near-drowning experience in a neighborhood pool. And what I remember, and it took years, Kak, for that memory to really come back, but when it did, all the memories came back. And that's not unusual for children who have NDEs when they're under the age of 5. So anyway, I was in the neighborhood pool. It was a hot summer day, and I was swimming and bobbing backwards in the shallow end of the pool, but it was one of those pools where the slope goes downward as it gets deeper, but I didn't realize that as I continued going backward, it was getting deeper. So I ended up not being able to touch the ground, the pool bottom, and started swallowing water, and then everything went black. And then I was out of my body and floating on the edge of the pool up in the side, and I could see my physical body on the bottom of the pool lying there. And back in those days, you had to wear like these little caps, and they were kind of plastic and kind of pulled your hair a little bit, but it was pink and it had these little scallops on it. And I saw the pink cap and I just saw me lying there. And what happened was I was in this place where I was just surrounded by love, peace, and just knowing things as much as you can possibly take in with a 4-year-old mind. But I just knew that this was love and peace. And I also knew that I could decide if I wanted to stay there and not come back. But what I also was aware of were feelings. I could feel my mother's feelings. And she was there at the pool that day where my brother and sister also were. And she had been distracted for a moment when there was a lifeguard on duty, but they didn't see me sink below the surface. And so when she looked and did not see me, she ran to the pool and then saw me on the bottom. As a nurse, she knew what to do. So she dived in, she got me out, and she told me that I was blue and I was not breathing. And so she put me on my stomach to revive me. And even in that time frame, my heart had not yet stopped, she later told me, but she knew I wasn't there. She knew I was gone and that I might not come back. So I remember feeling her feelings of fear and panic and grief and love, and it was very aware of just the feelings. And I loved my mother very much, and I just knew that she would never get over it if I didn't come back. And I also knew at that time that this life was going to be challenging. And that was part of the choice point that I had was, did I want to come back to this? Because it wasn't going to be easy. And in candor, it had not been. But I did come back. And then my conscious recall at that time is just, you know, spitting up water and coming back to consciousness and to this life. So what I didn't realize was that that portal had stayed open, and that left the door open for other experiences that happened later. Let me take a pause there, Kat. Did you have any questions at this point?
Yeah, because while you were floating above your body and your little pink cap was at the bottom, you saw some beings.
Well, what I encountered was a sense of beings. I'm not going to say that I saw them with my eyes or even my spiritual eyes. I was just aware of just being surrounded by beings of love. And that's, you know, in that moment, that's when I knew that I was never going to be alone on this journey, even if it was going to be a tough one. I just knew it wasn't, you know, I would not be alone, and that there was such love, again, that indescribable type of love.
So what would you say that the near-death experience gave you?
Well, it gave me a sense of that connection to love, that an awareness that we have choices in life of when we might leave it. We do get to have more control over it than we might think, and lots of times people aren't aware of that. I was also aware that as I have gone on, that while that love and that perfect kind of knowing, you know so much there that when you come back, you can't articulate, and it's almost hard to remember all of the things that you experience in that that time, that floating, loving time. But it's just a huge understanding that we are made of love and that we are surrounded by love. And then when we're here on the earth, and it's very jarring to find that so many times we're not surrounded by people who are loving, or just how tough this world can be, because we seem to have forgotten that we have that access to love and care.
Sure. You also had a grandma who was very sensitive. She was a Brauschau, if I can say, from your heritage and your lineage, and she also had like maybe a gift for seeing things. And do you think that that was handed down to you from grandma?
I think it was a both. I think that was a couple of things. One, from having that near death, but yes, grandma was Pennsylvania Dutch, and also my grandfather is Native American. So the two of them together, it was not unusual in their home when we were there frequently to have all kinds of unusual experiences. For example, my grandmother always knew when someone in her family passed away because her bedroom door would open and shut three times. And this happened over time. Or other times you get a knock on the door three times. Well, in Pennsylvania Dutch culture, three times is the symbol of the Trinity. And so when these things happened, she just accepted and knew without doubt that someone had died, and certainly she would get that phone call later or some other way of communication that indeed that had happened. My grandmother also saw my deceased aunt, which was her daughter, and we can talk about that a little bit later. She was very, very, very aware and very gifted, and also very into natural healing as well. And she used a lot of the Pennsylvania Dutch folk culture, which I've learned now is called powwowing or brachoré, And she, you know, it's not Native American, but that's part of the cultural heritage of the Pennsylvania Dutch. So she kind of wove that in, and so she was a real blessing for me to have as a grandparent, because being an unusual child, she understood a lot of things that were happening for me, or I could talk to her about floating around her house or things like that that would happen.
Well, now, she could have understood then when you had an incident with Uncle Howard, right?
Yes, she did. She did. And my incident with Uncle Howard was I was riding with my parents in the car, and we were going on some sort of day trip. And we had had this plan, but anyway, my Uncle Howard, my dad's brother, was going to drop by apparently our house, but we didn't know that. And so we're driving in the car, and I guess I was about 7 or 8 or so. I'm trying to remember, but I was under 10. I do know that much. And I all of a sudden could have a sense of him. I was seeing him in my mind's eye at our house knocking on the door. Well, we weren't there. And I spoke to my parents and said, well, you know, our Uncle Howard's at the house. And they said, no, he's not, honey. He's not coming over today, which, again, he wouldn't. We wouldn't expect him to be. And I just knew that he was there, but they didn't believe me. So I just, you know, what are you going to say? So, of course, we get home, and Uncle Howard had left a note that he had been by. So these things happened so frequently, and I just got used to knowing things or having an ability to see in my mind's eye what was happening in other places. I didn't have the words for it then at the time. Even when I had my near-death experience, that was in 1964, and that was before the term near-death experience was even coined. So there wasn't even any language to talk about these things. You know, this is before the terms like, you know, clairvoyance or precognition or any of these, you know, paranormal terms that we now have in the parapsychology lexicon, but we didn't have them back then. So to try to describe things as a child, you know, it just, everyone look at you like you're kind of crazy or weird. Like, how do you know that? How can you know that somebody's somewhere or visiting your house when you're not there? If you know, how could I even explain it?
Yes, and how did you explain that you saw an apparition of your dead aunt, Aunt Marion?
Yeah, that was a very difficult experience. I was 15 at the time that she passed away, and she was only 51 years old, and she had died from a very aggressive form of breast cancer that was diagnosed way too late to save her. But she was 12 years older than my mother and my mother's only sister. My mother felt like she was kind of a motherly figure to her, and they were very close. And my mom was grieving, it took her death really hard. And it was just put her in a terrible depression, and she was really struggling. And so my Aunt Marion, I called her in the book, appeared to me. A couple times, I had several encounters with her, but the first one was almost like in a dream state where I was kind of half asleep, and I saw her standing there, and this was like just a few days after she had died, and she was standing there, and she looked kind of horrific, like you know, like you would imagine from a horror movie, as though she were decaying, And I'll tell you a little bit what I learned about that later, but I remember being really frightened to see her this way. But her message was loving and kind. She wasn't trying to scare me. She just couldn't help how I was perceiving her being. And she was telling me, please tell your mother not to grieve. She's holding me back. And then she just kind of disappeared. And I remember being startled, fully awake, whether I was in sort of a semi sleep or not, but I was fully awake after that experience. But, you know, but that was, you know, the first contact with her. And then there were two more events, and then also something with my grandmother. So is there a preference you might have, Kat, on how I might describe these?
No, I think we can come back to that a little bit later. I want to fast forward through your life. You've had two kids, and you've had some health challenges with the children. You're divorced. You're struggling. And to add that, you're in school, you're getting a master's, and you're teaching. And so in an AA meeting, which you had joined because you wanted to get a handle on your own health and addiction, it prompted you to go visit somebody in the hospital. Now, you met this man's mother, and you also said the last thing I needed to do was take on another task, a visit to somebody I didn't even know, and it seemed senseless. So tell us about what you were doing and why you had these conflicting emotions.
Oh, gosh. Well, you're right. I was in grad school at the time. I was a teaching assistant. I was also an adjunct professor teaching, of all things, marriage and family relationships course. And I joked about that one, that I was teaching it because I'd done so many things wrong. I could tell the students what not to do. But I was a single mom at the time. I had been divorced for 5 years. Both of my sons had disabilities, and I had got my master's degree in public health to learn how to help them using holistic methods, maybe some complementary models. And one of the things I didn't know was how to assess what was a viable alternative rather than, you know, just something that would be something of false hope or things like that. But because of the boys' situations with their health needs, I learned about Reiki and energy healing. And so I went ahead and got my certification in that over a seven-year period because I found that it was very soothing and very calming for them. And also my mother, too, had trained in therapeutic touch, which is a nursing healing model using energy-based approaches, very similar to Reiki, different in some ways, but therapeutic touch, healing touch, Reiki, they're all very similar energy types of medicine with the same intention, which is to help heal people, help soothe pain, and provide a comforting experience. So I had learned this and had worked with some people in some health crisis situations and had some, you know, really positive results. But anyway, being a single parent and struggling with the boys' needs and being on my own and being a full-time grad student, I felt like I was drinking a little bit too much, and I was very worried about that. And so I took myself to an AA meeting and decided that, you know, the tools are really helpful for me. I had grown up with some alcoholism in my family, and I needed to understand this better and also to prevent going down a place I didn't want to go. So,
now let me just stop here for a second because I'd like to explain what Reiki is to our listeners who might say, Reiki, what's that?
Reiki is a Japanese-based model and using universal life energy. Like chi is similar to the Japanese word ki, which many people have heard too. And so ki is the Japanese word similar to chi. Let me rephrase that. And it's just using the body's energy field in a healing way. It is very similar to some traditions of laying on of hands in some religions. It's similar to healing touch, which, again, is using the body's energy field. It's not a religious model necessarily. You can bring your own faith if you want, but it's not about religion. It's about energy healing and balancing, and you know, it's very gentle, very soothing, and very respectful.
And you have training for this, and you get certified, and you were you had the Reiki tools at your hands in order to begin healing. And so you heard that someone was near death in a local hospital, and a lot of your friends and people in AA were very concerned about him. So you went anyway, in spite of having no time and conflicting emotions, like, why am I doing this? When you first saw the man, you described the experience as, the only signs of life were the beeps of the heart monitor and the ventilator breathing for him in a whooshing rhythm like a metronome set at a slow tick. You also wrote, he had dark tufts of hair poked through the tangled tubes and wires. So you walked into this room, and what happened?
Well, I went in because I had, let me just explain to your listeners that the night before I had met his mother. His name is David, and he had been diagnosed with a very rare form of vasculitis and had been in the hospital at that point for 3-plus weeks on life support with his kidneys had completely failed, had been destroyed. His lungs had all, he was on a ventilator. One lung had collapsed. Then he had a chest tube. He had double pneumonia. He had sepsis. He had blood clots. He was, his heart had gone into AFib, or it was out of rhythm. So he was in the cardiac care, intensive care unit, on life support. He'd gotten multiple blood transfusions, and it had taken them 13 consultations or thereabouts to finally diagnose what the very rare form of vasculitis that he had. And at that point, he had no longer responded to the treatment protocol. He was also in a paralytic coma, totally unresponsive. And he also, because he'd been on the ventilator for such a long time, he wasn't getting enough oxygen to the brain. And so he was having concerns that there was now encephalopathy and that he would have brain injury as well if he even lived. So the night that I met his mother, that very night before I went in to see him, she had flown in from San Francisco because she'd been called by the hospital to come to Richmond to come say goodbye because they was not expected to live. And I met her that night at the meeting where she was thanking everybody. And I'd gone to the meeting, which I hadn't been to in a long time, or my former sponsor was picking up a coin. And that's when I saw people I'd known standing around crying because they said he wasn't going to make it. And she had just come from the hospital where she'd signed the funeral directives. So that was one of the things, and I did not know David, but people thought we may have met, but we never had. But there was something about her that really touched my heart. I just was so moved by her love and care and her sorrow. And as a parent, all I could think is how hard it must be to have your child dying. I don't care how old your child is. They're always going to be your child. And so I was going to tell her I was sorry about this, but what came out of my mouth was, I don't think you should give up hope. And to this day, Kat said that. That was not me talking. And I told her I couldn't promise anything, but if she wanted to give me permission to go into the ICU, because I couldn't go without that, if he was even alive the next day, I would do whatever she would like me to do. And if that meant just go hold his hand and pray while he passed away, then I would do that. So she said she'd give me permission, again, with a big assumption. And I told her I did Reiki, and that's where she told me, well, he's Jewish. And I said, it's okay. It's not a religious thing at all. It's very respectful. And we both left it where we would check in kind of in the morning to see if he, you know, was still there. So I called the hospital. He was still alive, and I went, and they had finally added my name in. There was some confusion on that. And so when I walked into that hospital room, I had never seen anyone in acute kidney failure, so I didn't realize that their whole body is very bloated because they can't excrete urine. So just to be very medical about it. So he was just in a devastating spiral downward. And in fact, I think they were surprised at that point in the hospital that he was even still living. So what I did do was he had the wires and tubes. He had the feeding tube in his nose. He had the ventilator in his mouth, and everything was taped into place. And he obviously was unresponsive and unaware. But when I walked in, I did walk up to him, and my mother, the nurse, had always told me that when people are in a coma, they can still hear what you say. And so she would advise me to what I did. I introduced myself and told David who I was and why I was there, that he had a lot of friends who cared about him, that I had met his mother the night before, and I was here to see if I could offer a hand of help or whatever he was going to do, whether he wanted to stay or go, but to let him know that You know, he might have some unfinished business, and a lot of people care about him. And but yet, I also knew too, Kat, that healing is his journey, and it was his choice, and I had to respect what he wanted to do. So I had to ask his permission if I could even work with him. And even though he couldn't respond, because I had those abilities to sense people's feelings from that childhood experience that lingered on for all of my life, I told him I would just wait there till I got a sense of whether he was giving me permission to work with him. So I waited, and I felt a little puff of air, and that's when I knew that was his way of saying, okay, I could work with him. So that's what happened.
Okay, and then he's unconscious, and you're there. You've gotten your permission, and as you begin to work with him and place your hands, now, did you place your hands on his body or just over it at that time?
Well, at that moment, the first thing I did was I made contact by holding his hand, and this
okay.
is where, you know, I had to be very careful because he had IV lines in the hand, a pulse oximeter, and all sorts of equipment and tubes around the cot. So I just took his hand, and I was also attending a church at the time where I used, I was on the prayer team there, and we used a method called affirmative prayer, which is pretty much you speak words out loud of positive prayer, which is what you'd like to see happen for this person. So I opened with a prayer and gave thanks for this time together, you know, and just, again, but full respect to his healing journey, just stated, you know, we'd like to see, told him I believed in a miracle working God and that I would like to offer anything that I could to help him on his journey. So I did that. So I took his hand. I did place my hands in certain strategic Reiki places, like the top of the head, near what we call the third eye, and then very gently on the chest and the heart region. And then from there, I just did body scanning, which is the hand kind of scanning over the body, not touching at that point, just to get a sense of his energy. And when someone is that close to death, it's a very unusual kind of energy pattern that I learned from him, which was that the energy is very flat, but it's also very wide, meaning it takes a lot of energy too. But he wasn't really responding, CAC, at that point. And so I worked with him for about 15 minutes, and I just didn't have a strong sense of what was going to happen. So as I, you know, finished up, I took his hand and I was getting ready to say goodbye. And that's the point where, even though he couldn't respond and he had no grip, and I just told him I was getting ready to leave, and I said a closing prayer, and I felt as I was getting ready to take my hand away and leave, I felt my hand being fused, almost like magnetically connected to his. And again, he had no grip, so it wasn't as though he was holding my hand, because he wasn't. And that's when I realized that his spiritual energy was reaching back. And so I was a little startled by that, and just said to him, well, I can sense that there's some connection here, and I could feel so much of his feelings during the experience when I was working with him. And I just felt really moved by the whole experience. And I did tell him that if he decided he wanted to come back, that I would do whatever I could to help him get through this time. But it was, again, up to him, and whatever he chose to do would be perfectly fine. It was his choice. So, but I did tell him if he decided to stick around, I'd come back the next day.
Now, you also used a lot of praise in working with David, and you thanked his body and his organs
yes.
for doing such a good job, and yet they were all failing.
Right.
Tell us about that experience.
Well, that was, they were beyond failing, CAC. They had completely failed. His kidneys at that point were destroyed because what he had was a very rare form of vasculitis, including at that time it was called Wegener's granulomatosis. That's a fancy word for saying pretty much that little nodules would infiltrate the organ systems and leave scar tissue. It attacked all the vessels that feed the organs. So his organs had, the kidneys had been damaged beyond repair, and he was also having dialysis to keep him alive for that. But also his lungs had were in complete respiratory distress. They were just not functioning. That's why he was on the ventilator. But in affirmative prayer, what you do is you see in your mind's eye healthy functioning organs. So even though the evidence was that that was not the case, I knew that the prayer was that I was giving thanks to God and to the most sacred and highest and holy forces in the universe under God's creative hand, of this, the creator of the universe, whatever language makes sense to folks. I always say that, but that was the language I was using. I gave thanks that David's life was in the creator's hands and that the creator who created him could, you know, heal him completely. So I was holding that faith, and it, again, this is where words are hard to describe, that unusual sense of almost like being in two places at one time, even in that sense, because my mind certainly knows the reality now of what's going on for him and his, and what the prognosis and the doctors have said, but he was still alive. And so to me, I took that as hope. And so I could only do what I knew to do, which was to give thanks for the situation exactly as it was and give thanks for the healing taking place. And what I was seeing was light and love and the healing power of the universe coursing through his kidneys, his liver, his entire vascular system, and providing healing, nurturing, and nourishment. So these were some of the words I would use.
You also realized, and you said in your book, that in heaven, David was already healed. His earthly body,
yes,
was just catching up.
Yes, exactly. One of the prayers that I love and that I like, it's the Lord's Prayer, but there were seven words in it that when I said them, I realized just lit up for me. It was like, oh, and it's the prayer part where on earth as it is in heaven. And so that was it. It was like, as it is in heaven. And then on earth is a reflection of that. And I thought, well, if he is completely healed in the heavenly realms, then it has to be true that his physical self will also heal because it will reflect. It will echo from the universal truth of that healing that's already done. So I know I'm talking about very high-level metaphysical concepts, but when we were in that moment, it was, I could feel the spiritual truth of it. So it's really hard to describe it any better than to say that I could feel it in my bones, the truth of it. And
well, now,
so that's, say I could just feel it. It was unequivocally true. And I just didn't have any doubt that that was at that time, that when I'm in that moment, that this was true, that he was healed.
Now, around session 4 or 5, you said that you felt you were no longer in your own body.
Right. And now that was where we had a very unusual experience. When I went in, obviously he was staying here. He was still staying present and still alive. And so I went in that day, and remember, as you pointed out, I was a divorced single mom. I had been very busy with everything and just trying to, with school. So, but I wasn't, you know, I just didn't have anyone in my life really at that point, and certainly wasn't thinking about him that way. So what happened was when I did take his hand and I started with the opening prayer, which I did every time that I had gone to visit him, and I'd gone every day, At one moment, I'm standing there at his bedside, and the next moment, I'm out of my body, and this is where I'm in a place similar to what was like my near-death experience, but different. And what was the same was this love, this incredible, indescribable place of love. And I'm floating in this light. They're like, I call it like millions and millions of liquid drops of light and love, except it's not wet. There's no words to describe the textures and the sense of it. But I'm aware that I'm in this incredible light and love. And because I was holding his hand at his bedside, and I'm now aware that in the spiritual realm where I am, there he is. And I'm by holding his spiritual hand in this spiritual realm, and that's where we met in that way. That's when I realized that, oh, my gosh, I know this. I know him. My spirit knows him and has always known him, and being surrounded by this complete love. And I knew everything about him at that point. And later, you know, well, I don't want to say too much, but it's just that's when we knew each other and knew that we'd always loved each other. And again, this is so hard to put into words because I had not met him in the physical world except as an unconscious dying person. And I didn't really know much about him at all because, again, we had not met. So to have be surrounded all of a sudden and realize this is the person I've always loved in some spiritual deep way, like my soulmate, and then I'm just feeling these feelings, and I can't tell you how long it was. I don't think it was long in human terms, but the experience when you're in these kind of realms, it's timeless. There's just no sense of timing, except that then I'm swapped back in my body, and I'm standing there at the side of the bed holding his hand just as I was when I had finished my opening prayer. He's still unconscious, and I'm startled. I'm shocked about what has happened here. I can't even process what has happened. I don't even know what to make of what happened and how this can possibly be that I could have this experience with this man who is a stranger to me, of such love and knowing and awareness and understanding, and here he is unconscious and still dying. I didn't know what to make of this.
Do you think it was a past life visitation?
I don't know, because there was, you know, I've been asked that, and the best way I can say is my spirit has always known him. I feel like I have always known him forever. And so if we've had different lifetimes together, that could be. But that was not what this was about, candidly. It was more just a connection of souls and in a loving spiritual plane. And that was all there was, just that deep, deep knowing of the sense of eternal connection and timelessness and love and destiny.
You also said that you realized there was a huge force more powerful than you, and that force was in charge of this whole thing.
Yes. I absolutely felt that way, because it logically defied thing. It just didn't make logical sense why any of this was happening. Again, I was a struggling mom. I was on the college campus 5 days a week in between doing my graduate teaching assistantship and then my own class and 3 times a week. And so, and then, you know, when you're a student, you're still kind of broke. So I would joke about it. It's like I barely had enough gas to put in the car to make the trip to the hospital. And I certainly didn't know how I could help someone this seriously ill and this close to death. None of it made any kind of logical sense. I had never worked with anyone that critically ill. I had no idea in a logical way why I was even there. Each time my mind tried to argue with me about it, like, what are you doing? The spiritual component, the knowing, I call it, just told me I had to do this. I owed him something. And so back to your question, is there a past life component here? I feel that obviously there was a sense of owing, like it was a privilege to be there to help, that I owed him something. I don't know, again, what exactly was, but I felt that I did. So maybe we could say there's some karma to that. But most of this felt like a compellingness from a spiritual pull that was more powerful than my logical mind, and it certainly overruled the logical mind. And so I listened to it, and I kept showing up no matter how dire the situation was.
So who were the blue beings?
Okay, well, that happened next. Because David did show some signs of improvement, but they said that even if he did survive, and now there might be a glimmer of hope that he might, because he had not yet passed on, they said that even if he did survive, his kidneys were destroyed and that kidneys don't regenerate. Now, true that if they shut down, and lots of times in an ICU setting, the kidneys will fail, but they'll return to function in time. But when they're destroyed, as these were with the granulomas, they said that they can't, they don't regenerate and they're not going to heal. If they heal at all, it'll be a tiny bit of function returning, but he'll need lifelong dialysis if he did survive it, and that he would not be eligible for a transplant list because of the devastation of the vasculitis, which, again, is also a very not a great prognosis, even if you do survive it. So,
yeah, and let me just insert here that Wegener's granulomatosis is a disease that of the granuloma, which forms a coating around your organs, beginning with your sinuses, working down into your lungs. And when it hits the liver and kidneys, your chance of survival is not nil.
Right. That's correct. And here's the other thing, Kak, and just to add this so people can understand the gravity of the situation, is David's medical records were looked at, and they said any one of the things that he had going on, any one of them, could have killed him. But the combination was not survivable. And so the fact that he was still alive at this point was stunning. Anyway, he had shown just a tiny bit of kidney function returning, and they said that again would probably be the best it was going to be, but again. So as I continued my prayers, part of the affirmative prayer that came out of my mouth was, when I would ask for the highest and best, most sacred and holy. These are words I had never used before. Don't know why I said them, but I was in the moment. And I said, in this dimension or any other, under the creative and sacred hand of God. So I didn't want any energy that wasn't positive, high, and holy. That was critically important to me. I know as a healer and as an person who's had that portal to the other side open, there's energies out there I don't want. But I wanted only the best, but in this dimension and any other. So later, that I guess it was probably 5 or 6 days in, that night, again, I was in my room getting ready for bed, and doing my nightly prayers, and I would say my prayers at night for David's healing and just continue those. And I was kind of thinking I was falling asleep when my mind's eye, kind of like the time when I saw my Uncle Howard at the door, even though I'm in the car, in my mind's eye, I'm seeing David in his room at the hospital. And what I'm seeing in my mind's eye are four beings that look like they're colored blue to me, and they're very tall, and there's one at each end of the cot and one on each side. And what I'm seeing, Kak, and again, is as though they're like, to me, they seem like a team of medical doctors that they were just blue colored, and then they looked a human, humanish, but they looked like they were in surgical scrubs, and they were blue, very tall. But what I saw was, again, I'm just perceiving this, like a set of kidneys that they were like a holographic image of kidneys, like they were dropping a set of these spiritual kidneys into his body in the kidney area. And I thought, okay, well, this is either I'm having some sort of dream experience, or I'm just maybe fantasizing. I'm that logical mind's always kicking in, but it's still I'm observing this. What was unusual was the what I call the lead doctor, for lack of a better term, the one who was, you know, kind of putting the kidneys into his body, looked up and looked like they nodded at me, like they saw my spiritual energy or sensed my presence in the room. And so I was startled by that and didn't know what to make of it. And so I went on, you know, to sleep and woke up very, very early the next morning and went into the hospital. And I took some additional healing tools with me, like tuning forks, and I was using some aromatherapy and also some essential oils for his feet. And that's another healing piece that I can talk about in clinical settings. But anyway, when I went to the hospital the next day, David's nephrologist had been called in because David's kidneys were starting to dramatically return to function, and they couldn't understand what was happening or how that was happening. So at that point, that's when the doctors and nurse calling him Miracle Boy and said that something was going on that they couldn't explain. And so David's still not conscious at this point, but his kidney function is returning, and it began to return on an exponential level. So that's the story of those beings and his kidneys.
Wow. Well, you know, we can do a lot of things these days by calling Uber and fast delivery systems, but that's a pretty interesting delivery system you conjured up there from the other side. So, yeah, I'd say that's pretty spectacular. Now, how many times did you visit David in all?
I went for 12 days straight. And the second week when he, after the kidney experience, where it seemed like he was going to make a recovery, I went in twice a day. And I brought in a little portable CD player that had Reiki music, and I would play that. Also, because of the anoxia and the concerns about his brain function, I asked for headphones, and I would ask that we put music on so that to keep his brain kind of stimulated, not overstimulated, just for periods of time so that he could have music to engage his brain. You know, I used, like I said, omega-3 fatty acids and omega-6 oils on his feet because people who are in a coma or not long-term support like that aren't getting enough essential fatty acids, which are really critical for the body's function. These are a lot of things I learned in my master's in public health training and research about how to help children with, you know, ADHD and epilepsy, which my sons had. So I was looking at brain healing technologies and nutrition. So I would bring these things in as well and use those with David. But, yeah, for a 12-day period, I worked with him, and I was certainly praying morning and night for his healing and recovery during that very, very intense period.
Well, and this wasn't an easy trip to the hospital. You had to drive, wasn't it 90 miles each way?
No, it wasn't that far. Really across town. The hospital was in the west end. I was in the south side. So it was about a 20-minute drive each way, door to door. But I had to go another way to go to school. So it was kind of a triangle around, you know. And then when I was driving back and forth, because I just knew that as critically ill as he was and the recovery he was trying to have happen needed more intense Reiki and energy healing work. So I was committed. I had made a promise to him that I would commit myself to helping him see this through if he was making a choice to return, which it seemed that he was.
So you didn't know David. You'd met his mother at an AA meeting. It was your idea to go. Now, who does that, Scarlett?
Right, exactly. That's what I would say to my friends. I was like, I don't know what's happening here. This doesn't make any logical sense. None of it does. And, you know, and yet I was tugged by that spiritual call. To me, it was a spiritual honor to be in service this way, to use these gifts that I felt that I did have from childhood on. And not only that, Kat, the energy with him was, I felt like we had, were, because of that out-of-body time with him on that loving energy time that was very similar to when I was out of body in my own near-death experience. He was in his near-death experience, so I got to be there with him while he was hovering out of his body, determining whether he was going to stay or go. You know, people in a coma are in a different type of near-death experience, and that's where he was. We didn't even have words for that until Raymond Moody came up with the term shared death experience. Well, he did, you know, we didn't have that because he was in a near-death state. So we had a shared near-death where I was able to be with him while he's near-death, deciding whether he's going to stay or go. So there was a lot of spiritual sacredness going on. Also, as I pointed out, David is Jewish, and all this was taking place over the High Holy Days in the Jewish traditions and in 2005. So we're talking, well, be 18 years in the fall since this happened. So there was a lot of sacred spiritual energy that felt it was all woven into this encounter. So I viewed the whole experience as a sacred experience and learning about love and connection in a different way. I mean, how could you love, have these feelings of love? And it wasn't romantic. Let me be clear about that. I call it an every kind of love because there's no, again, we don't have words in the human, in this earth form to describe that kind of love that I experienced in my own near-death experience and then in that shared near-death experience with David. There just aren't words to describe this all-encompassing everything kind of love. That's the best way I can say it. So I didn't understand the awakening I was having in just my human life to this understanding that this kind of love exists. It's very real. And I knew it from my childhood, but to have it reiterated with him, again, he's still unconscious, and he's seeming to recover in stunning ways. I don't even know. I'm a witness to what I feel is looking like a miracle. At the same time, I'm experiencing it, but I don't have any way to process it because I'm right in the middle of it. So it was a very unusual time, and the only thing I could do was show up. That was it, and just keep showing up and see what happened.
Now, Scarlett, you've also had experience working in the financial field, and you're mm-hmm. internationally known for your work as a theorist and a researcher in the area of women's financial health and social norms theory.
Yeah.
And besides the healing that you have been studying and work with, you are concentrating on financial inclusion, diversity, and equity in the payment system.
Yeah.
Now, if you didn't have to make money in the world to support yourself, what would you primarily be doing with your time after you've had this experience?
Well, I would be doing more teaching about, you know, healing on all levels. I do view money as financial health and healing as a marker of healing. I see how important it is. As a struggling single mother, I knew what it was like to be broke and struggling. And so I would like to help women understand how to work with money, how to view money more energetically. And how to work with it in a way that serves them rather than them being kind of rolled over by the whole economic system. So that's all part of healing. I'd like to also teach about the methods that I used with David because they were Reiki, but they were a combination of multiple disciplines. And by that I mean they were science-based because I was pulling in what I had learned about you know, physiology and nutrition from my master's research work. So I was looking at all of that. I was looking at some of the other modalities out there in addition to Reiki, but like using aromatherapy, using the sound and music, using the tuning forks and the energy of that, and using some spiritual traditions too. I didn't realize at the time that I was actually using intuitively some Pennsylvania Dutch techniques, such as just feeling that sense of connection to those roots. So all of those things were woven in. But I really also I want to point out a little bit too, one of the reasons I went ahead and got certified in hypnotherapy was, having researched it, you know, there's so much power of the mind. And so when someone's unconscious or in a self-hypnosis or a hypnosis state, the mind doesn't quibble. It doesn't understand that if you're telling it it's healthy, it doesn't argue, it believes. And so I felt like there was something in the affirmative prayer, in addition to the energy and combination, that was very powerful, because David could hear the words I was saying, that his organs were healthy, and being in the state that he was in, he could believe it. And I believe that that assisted and facilitated his healing. So I would like to, you know, teach people about how to combine many of these methods in a way that might, perhaps in a clinical setting, that might actually help people expedite their healing, their recovery, and really look at this on a serious level, because
it's
so easy.
I hate to interrupt, but we have about 3.5 minutes left.
Okay.
Well, yes, and I think we can pretty much do this with just saying thank you to you, Scarlett, for being here tonight. And people can find your book, We Met on the Other Side, to find out what happens in this drama. Did David get well? Did he not get well? What happened? Were there more blue people that came to visit him? This indeed is a book that will keep you flipping the pages and keep your mind focused on what can happen when healing takes place within a person, and certainly between two people. It's a fascinating book. It's a wonderful story that Scarlett has shared with us. And I just want to ask Scarlett to leave us with her last and final thoughts in the next 30 seconds. And thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Kat. It's been an absolute pleasure. I want to leave folks with this thought. I want you to know that there is so much love in the universe for you. And I want to repeat that. There is so much love in the universe for you. And if you can believe that, just even a tiny bit, this is where miracles can happen in your life. So thank you for having me, Kat. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. You're a wonderful guest. Hercules, thank you for the pleasure and privilege of this hour. Good night, and God bless everybody.
And thank you, Kat, for a wonderful show. And Scarlett, you're an awesome guest. So we've spoken before. I've read your book, and you're phenomenal. You were just as captivating this time around. Thanks to all, and especially our audience. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody.